89.1 WGZS Cloquet. I'm Dan Hucklack. I have a special guest on the phone, and we will get to him in a moment. But first, the Black Bear Casino Resort is celebrating Native American Heritage Month with three free concert performances. And the final concert features Brulé, one of the top-selling Native American music groups, and they are returning to the Bear for another performance. Brulé is best known for thrilling audiences with emergence of cultural rock and theatrical instrumentations. The group has released 21 titles in two decades, and they have been named Group of the Year five times by the prestigious Native American Music Awards, known as NAMI, and they have earned seven NAMIs since 2002. And now our special guest. Today we have the founder of Brulé, Mr. Paul LaRoche. Paul, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Dan, thank you for that. Thank you for that wonderful intro, and thank you for the invitation to be part of your program. Thanks so much.
Well, the pleasure is all mine. We have some of your music in our library, and it's so powerful and soothing, and it's orchestral. I've referred to it that way before, and it's amazing how much sound you get out of a group with primarily five members. Am I correct?
The core group has been five most of the time, Dan. And we're a family group, you know, so it's essentially, you know, my daughter and my son, myself. We're all three musicians, and I play keyboards. Nicole, my daughter, is our lead instrumentalist. She plays the flute. My son takes care of the guitar work. And then I have a nephew that is on drums part of the time, and another traditional drummer that's from the city of Omaha, Nebraska. Now, we kind of make up the core group, but, you know, we also include a dance troupe with our show, which is a very important part of the presentation. And so the dance component has been with us for both decades as well. So combined, many times we have, you know, we'll have anywhere from 10 to 15 performers. So, yeah, five members in the core group. And with our main dancers, there's about 8 to 10 of us that really kind of make up the regular performance cast of Brulé.
I have to go back to your beginning in terms of being a musician and tell you that I watched your 2007 performance, that concert at Mount Rushmore, and I followed your statement at the very beginning of the show, and I thought, very compelling, very moving. And can you share a little bit of that with our listeners, please, what you said, and, you know, a little bit more about yourself?
Sure. Thanks for asking, Dan. Our life story is a little bit unusual, although you and I kind of share some common life experiences. But I always tell people, I've shared our story so many times, I'll give you kind of the five-minute version here and see if I can do it. I was one of the Native American children who was adopted at birth and removed from our country's reservation systems. As fate would have it, I wound up in the loving care of two very beautiful and wonderful parents, and I grew up as part of a small white middle-class farming community in southwest Minnesota, a small town called Worthington. The strange little twist, Dan, in my story is that I was never told of my true American Indian heritage. And I always like to add this little bit that I think it was taboo back in those earlier times for families to openly share and proclaim their Native American genealogy. Times are different now, but it was a different country back then, and that information many times was kept secret. In the worst cases, it was swept under the rug, and families lost that information forever. So I was never told of my American Indian heritage. I was told I was French-Canadian, which was partially correct, I came to find out years later.
Sure.
And the years passed. I have the best of memories as a young boy. The years went by. I graduated and got married and grew up. And at the age of 38, I lost both of my parents in the same year within a very close period of time, several weeks. And after that had happened, my wife, Kathy, had found some information as she was going through my parents' personal belongings. She discovered some of my adoption papers. This is information that had been hidden for years. And she came across that information, Dan, and she wanted to search it out, but she kept it secret from me. I think she realized it was very important, that something that she considered part of her life's mission. So she began a search unbeknownst to me that lasted 5 years. And so it was 2 weeks before Thanksgiving of 1993, 5 years after that discovery of that information, that she connected me up on a phone call one night with a gentleman who introduced himself as my biological brother. She had found my biological family living on a small reservation.
Wow.
In central South Dakota. And then the two of us went on to share our life stories. And at the end of the conversation, my brother said, come on home. And we did. We took a journey out to the reservation that Christmas. And so began the Brulé journey.
That is phenomenal. you were blessed with having your adoptive parents and how they raised you unconditionally and with love. And, you know, you didn't see a lot of that. But then as an adult, you had to learn about your culture. Very similar to my story, although I wasn't adopted. Can you talk about the transition of straddling the Lakota and mainstream non-Native cultures?
Yeah, I'd be honored to. It's kind of, it's a very interesting study on human behavior and a look at our cultures here in the world, not just in America. So I am continuing to this day going through a process that I call reverse assimilation. I'm trying to go back into my culture that was removed at birth. And since I began this at kind of midlife, I find myself going at double or triple speed. I mean, that's human nature. That's the longing of the heart to want to absorb as much of your given birthright as you possibly can. And so everything comes in fast and furious. And, you know, every visit that we've had along the way, you know, I should just throw this in. It's been almost 25 years since we've been reunited with my biological family. And in our travels, to this day, I still am meeting cousins and distant relatives that I've never met before. So it just continues on, and I'm sure it will through the balance of our life. But the really odd thing is, you know, if the observations, if I were to, and I have written a book once, I have to do another one because so much has happened, but my observations are a little unique. I found myself at a strange juncture, even the first visit onto the reservation. It almost seemed as if we couldn't wait to get onto the reservation. I mean, we raced across the boundary, the border, and we were just, I mean, we couldn't wait to arrive at my brother's house. But it's almost as if while we were scrambling to come onto the reservation, you know, it was almost at the same time that I could see kids and other people that couldn't wait to leave the reservation.
Sure.
And if I even think that our cars crossed paths as that moment was happening. And, you know, it's just a different look at your culture. I mean, that continues to this day. You and I both know that there's a great influx off the reservations by many of our tribal individuals that can't wait to leave and get out there into the world. And of course, the cycle is kind of the same. You know, the reality check of leaving the reservation and trying to get out into the world is sometimes harsh and unfriendly, and a lot of our tribal members come back. You know,
definitely
come back, and that cycle kind of goes on and on. That loop continues off the reservation, on the reservation, trying to find our place in mainstream America. And so, you know, I guess I was part of that, but, you know, my longing was to come back. We actually moved on the reservation, Dan, lived there for almost 10 years. I will say 9 full years. And that was a tough kind of a transition. We were living in Minneapolis, a suburb of Minneapolis at the time. So we literally packed up our stuff and left Minneapolis behind and ended up on the Lower Brule Sioux Reservation. Now, that's the smallest of the Lakota reservations. So, and it's very remote, beautiful country, but a harsh, drastic difference from the world that we had lived in. And so for us, it was like moving and living on almost in a third world country. And you can imagine the experiences and the things you go through in that process. I mean, I suppose it's kind of similar to some of the missionary work an individual takes off for Haiti or Africa. I mean, those experiences, try to tell those experiences, I don't think they're probably that different from what a family like us went through. And you do go through that today. So, you know, I mean, it's just, I for me to go on would be fruitless, because there's so many stories, so many elders we've met, so many chance encounters of ceremonies that we had no concept of until we were part of it, and the family members, and trying to understand Native America's place in the world today. It's just ongoing, day by day, minute by minute.
Yes, it's phenomenal. And there's a saying I like to say sometimes, it doesn't matter how old you are, but as long as you're still breathing, you still have the opportunity to learn and learn something new, and that experience that you talked about. You know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you came home to the reservation and then you started your musical career, and I'll get into more of that as we go, but meeting a lot of your family, you know, your blood relatives, and not knowing they were even alive until you were an adult, and then you come home, and now as you're performing, traveling, recording, and you're able to do so with your daughter, Nicole, and later on your son, Shane, what does that make you feel like? Because you get to spend so much time with family and the success and all of it. It's an all-encompassing thing, but it's got to be rewarding.
Well, it is. It's a blessing. I mean, that's just my first, that's the first thing that comes to my head. The reality of it, Dan, is such that I had to be very careful. I grew up with my adoptive parents. I was given the opportunity to expand my love for music as a youngster. I mean, they supported that, and they allowed me to move on in the world of music, bought instruments for me. You know, those things that would have never happened on the reservation. But like all of us, I mean, the music business beat up my family and I up pretty good. In my early, throughout my 20s, you know, survival and was pretty difficult. I was in and out of music and had basically given up on music when this discovery of the New Heritage came along. And so, you know, coming back to reservation, it was the support and it was the encouragement from my biological family, from my Lakota family, to actually go back into the world of music. We had thought we'd kind of washed our hands and we're done with it. And we're licking our wounds. When the new family said, listen, you know, you have been given some opportunity that would never have come to any of us on the reservation here from as far back as we can remember. And we think that you should probably go back out into the world. And now you can represent your culture and you can represent our community. And we'll have a voice out there, a musical voice in the world. And so, you know, that I had to process that a little bit because there's a part of you that says, well, maybe this looks like I'm trying to exploit the culture. And I don't want that to be. I mean, I knew that wasn't the case, but I didn't want it to appear that way.
Sure.
The very important component was having the blessing of your community to do that. So once that set in and it stuck, and we went back out into the world, and, you know, I'll put it to you this way, Dan. I think one of the missing components when I was younger and trying to survive in the world of music was what I would call inspiration. Not that I didn't enjoy music, and believe me, we played music in and out of rock bands and, you know, just having a great time. But if we were trying to write music, original music, nothing came out. I didn't have the right materials of the heart to process and to be a true composer of musicians. I was just more of a performer back in those days. So coming back to the reservation and beginning to live these experiences, the floodgates opened up and the inspiration came in such a quantity that I couldn't hardly harness it. And to this day, I have more inspiration than I can really handle. So, you know, the music was just a byproduct of the experiences that we were starting to go through. So when you look back at it, I realized that, you know, a complete artist in terms of music needs to have some talent. It's the smaller component. You need to have a support system, but you need that inspiration. That's the trigger. And that's the spiritual thing. I don't know. You can't manufacture it. It has to come from somewhere in your life that's real. It has to be a real thing. It has to come from that place that we can't define. And so it's kind of a gift when it comes along. So the whole thing is a very humbling journey, very humbling, especially when it starts at midlife. When you realize that now you've been given a blessing, you've got a culture that supports you for the most part, and you have encouragement, and there's a fan base, there's interest in the culture, and you've got inspiration, you know, of such magnitude that it never runs out. It's really a blessing. It's overwhelming, I would say overwhelming. To this day it is. And very rewarding. You mentioned traveling and working with your family. That's just a side. That's one of the fringe benefits that I wasn't anticipating at all. If I'd have known we were going to be a family group like the Partridge family, Kathy and I would have had more children. We only had two. So we would have had six. We had our own band at that point. But, you know, all jokes aside, it is the thrill of a lifetime to be able to perform something that you love. In our case, it was music. And to be able to do it with your family, your children. And it even goes past that, Dan. There's times on stage now, we've been around long enough that our grandchildren are in the performance with us too. So there's moments on stage when, as a performer, I can look across the stage from left to right and see my son and daughter enjoying themselves and see our grandchildren dancing.
Three generations. It's a beautiful thing.
It is. And when that hits, that's such a rare moment. That's the spiritual moment that it's really hard to describe. It's a blessing, and it's something I never anticipated.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Well, but the key word, thank you, is humbling. It has been a humbling journey. It's just, I think anybody would say the same thing, put in a situation.
Oh, it's amazing. We're here with Paul LaRoche, and he is the founder of the group Brulé. He also plays electronic keyboard, piano. He does the vocals as well, or some of the vocals. Songwriter, producer. Paul, we talked about performing with family, and I read, I believe it was on your group's website, talking about like the very beginning, and your debut traveling with Nicole was rather modest. And could you ever have imagined 2 decades later that your career in music would have evolved to such a remarkable story and success?
Never. I mean, it didn't. No. I wish I could say that I had a little bit of a vision for the future back then, but we didn't. I didn't know. I mean, here was the situation on the first performance, and I like to tell this little story because it's real. I was going to go perform. Kathy had found a place where I could play, a little art show, so she was getting me ready to go perform. I had borrowed a keyboard and borrowed a car, and we had $50, and we had our first box of CDs, and they come in these 30-count boxes.
Yep.
So I had 30 CDs, and I was kind of scared to death, mostly because we had no idea if people were going to embrace this music, laugh at it, think it's weird, you know, kind of walk past, and we have no idea. When We the People came out, which is the first CD we released, there was literally none of us had any idea if we'd even sell that first 30-count box of CDs.
Wow.
And so I was a little bit nervous. You have that feeling that maybe it'll be embarrassing. Well, we got to the show, and before the show happened, Nicole said, "Dad," and I think she was a little bit worried about me, and she said, "I'll come with you if it's okay, and I'll play flute." She played the flute through all the way through school, and she was in some elevated music programs, but had given up the flute because she didn't care for classical music. So she hadn't played flute for a couple, 2 or 3 years, and she volunteered to come with me, and we got to the art show, and we began to play, and we went through those first 30 CDs in the first 15 minutes of a 3-day weekend. So we knew that something was up. That's all I can say. And we took mail orders after that, and we just never looked back. Kathy began to book more dates. The group expanded as the months and years went by, and we just kept playing as much as we could, almost like every performance was going to be our last. That's just the feeling that we had, and that's how we approached it. So we gave it all we had, and that's how we've done it to this day. And first thing you know, 2 decades have gone by, and it's been the blink of an eye.
It's truly amazing. You know, both you and myself, we grew up off reservation, mainstream America, if you want to call it that. But you come back into our respective communities, and my job in radio, your job, I almost don't want to call it our job. If you really, truly enjoy what you're doing, you'll never work another day in your life. And I don't remember who said it, but I totally agree with it. Well, I guess what I was getting at was you're performing. You sell those first early CDs. You didn't think you would, as you mentioned a moment ago. One of the things I had to wonder is learning about the contemporary native music scene.
Yeah.
Some of the hardest things to do is find record labels.
Yeah.
There are so many artists out there that they just don't have that exposure, and the talent is amazing. But I got to ask you, was it a struggle to find a record label originally?
I'm so glad that you asked that, Dan. Thank you, first of all. I would say that if during this entire process, if there was anything that I would call, you know, the hurdles that we had to overcome or the obstacles that we faced, and of course, as you can imagine, there's plenty, not for us, but for any artist out there. But I always like to say that we carried some extra luggage, and you know, and it was a little, things were threefold more difficult for a group like ours. And how I tell the story these days when it comes to that particular situation that you're talking about is that I believe that the group Brulé and a few others out there have been at work at what I call pioneering one of the last musical frontiers. And perhaps it is the last musical frontier. Now, you and I have referred to it. We've been saying contemporary American Indian music. And that's a mouthful when you really think about it, because when I look, as I've studied the music side of our culture, and I grew up as a kid that was a young rock and roller, so I like to feel I was, you know, I kind of grew up with mainstream music, now trying to find how that fits into the Native American culture. What I found clearly along the way that is within our culture, within the Native American culture, there's clearly two defining categories of music and artists and performers. And the first would be indigenous performers that have embraced mainstream music genres. So in other words, I'm talking about native guys that are playing jazz, blues, rock, pop, country, hip hop, any of those styles. And they've abandoned kind of the culture so that they could fit into the existing music genre. That's the first category. Now we have a category of native indigenous artists who are trying to carve out a niche for our culture in the mainstream music industry by hanging on to some sort of identifying factors culturally that we have that can be translated musically. And I believe that we're the last to do this because when you look across, I mean, I've tried to do a little study of world music, and when you begin to look across the board, you see that other cultures, the Latin music explosion that took place back in the 80s and 90s, Celtic music, you know, the show River Dance,
absolutely,
Middle Eastern music going gangbusters, Mexico, South American music, Brazil, reggae, tropical sound, French pop, opera, Latin, Afro-Cuban sounds, rhythmic calypso. I mean, all these have got a cultural component. Where's Native America in that mix? You know, we don't exist.
Yeah, definitely.
But we have our traditional music, so we have that other little third part in our culture that's alive and doing well. We have the powwow circuit. The powwow circuit is kind of, it's for us mostly. It's for us within the culture, and
yeah,
the mainstream loves to come and watch it. But they don't really embrace it or absorb it as much as they would like to because they don't understand it. They like to watch the dance, but it isn't like powwow records are flying off the shelf in record stores. It's a subculture and kind of an underground movement musically.
Yeah,
but it's very important that it exists and it's healthy. It's much healthier than contemporary American Indian music because we don't have many contenders. And that's part of our problem is that, you know, when you look around a group like Brulé, we're in such a small, we're such a small company, Dan, that, you know, I don't know. I mean, I thought about this before you called today. There maybe is four groups like Brulé, maybe. And the reality is probably just two or three of us that are working hard at really trying to hang on to this pioneering process and do it with respect. That's the other thing, is that the whole time we're trying to do this, we're trying to work around a set of parameters that are very, very defining, and we have to be so careful. You know, we don't want to lose the respect of our tribal communities, so we can't overexploit the culture, and we can't underexploit it, or it won't have the identifying musical components that we need. So somewhere there's a fine line of making it sound a little native without being stereotypical or without being exploitive. And you can, I had a friend once who told me, a tribal elder, said, you know, Paul, you have to find a way to push that envelope as far as you can without breaking it. You can't break it or you're done for, but you have to push that line as far as you can and carve this out, and you just have to work at it. And so that's just a little observation now that you asked that question. And I think that our culture is, we are emerging at this time, even this phone call, you and I, and anybody who's listening, the process of our culture coming into the mainstream really is just happening. Even though we put 23 years into it, it's just taking shape. We don't have categories. You know, you mentioned the NAMIs. Well, we'd like to participate in the Grammys, but there's no category for contemporary American Indian music, so you can't even compete. You can't enter. You have to end up in country, or you'll have to submit your material in one of the other existing categories.
Yeah, that's tragic.
Yeah, and there's no infrastructure, musical infrastructure. There's no record labels. There's no entertainment agencies, management, booking agents that know what to do with our culture or know what to do with a group like Brulé, because they don't know where to put us. They can't put us in the country circuit. We don't fit. They can't put us in the pop rock market. We don't fit. They can't even put us in many of our tribal casinos because in some cases, not all, Black Bear is to be commended because they're ahead of the curve. But a lot of the tribal casinos out there have given up their entertainment space to the big name country acts, and we can't even get in.
Wow.
So our own circuit is lost. It's really a difficult undertaking that most people don't know about, but I won't go on anymore, but that's some of the plight of trying to carve out this last musical frontier.
Well, and we talked about it. You touched on it, carving a niche into music, and, you know, with all the barriers and difficulties going on, your sound is so unique. You could jump into about three different genres and nobody would know, but it's, as I alluded to earlier, it sounds orchestral. It sounds like a giant orchestra the size of the old Chicago Transit Authority, Chicago having a, you know, 15 people on stage, wind instruments and everything. And you're doing it, you know, with flute, guitar, drums, traditional drums, modern drum, and keyboard. It sounds so rich, so soothing. But then you have your powerful pieces like Tatanka. You must be overdubbing.
Well, there's a little overdubbing, actually, you know, that goes on there in the studio. But, you know, first of all, thanks for the wonderful compliments and observations on the music. You know, really, I would like to say that we created that, and I had a part of that, but I can't really even do that, Dan, because really what it is, it's like every artist. I mean, we borrow from what we've grown up with. We borrow from the music of the past. And you know, there's 88 notes in the keyboard. They've all been used. I mean, you can't. There's only so many new combinations of things that happen musically. But every once in a while, you find a way to put them together that is unique. And I think that's what we stumbled across. And it goes beyond music, composing, and writing. And once again, it's that thing. It's that spirit. It's the heart that... It's the inspiration that comes to you, and you try to translate that. Music is the only medium that you have to work with, and that's what comes out. So really, the music of Brulé, we borrowed heavily on the musical influences that I grew up with and listened to back in the 60s and 70s, you know, and I was a big rock and roll, you know, fan and kid. So, you know, I loved everything. I listened to all the British rock groups that came over. They were all inspirational. I liked the heavy stuff. I liked Pink Floyd, and I liked, you know, the hard-hitting groups like AC/DC. I love the melodic composers and writers like Billy Joel,
yep,
and balladeers, and I loved it all. I mean, I embraced most kinds of music, but it was all music that came from a certain era, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so there's no way that you can deny that sound and those influences come out in your own music, and they have. So I borrowed, and I'm honest, and I've used them in the best way I could, and if it ends up that it sounds a bit orchestral, it's simply because you're trying to merge massive amounts of musical influence together at one time and induce a little bit of your culture into it simultaneously. And that's how it, in our case, that's how it came out.
And you do it very well. And trust me, when I say it sounds orchestral, that is the highest compliment I can think of, because the music is so much more powerful than the number of people producing it, playing it.
Well, thank you. I mean, I just, once again, I'm humbled, and I really appreciate your observations. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. We're here with Paul LaRoche. He's the founder of Brulé, and the group is coming to the Black Bear Otter Creek Event Center November 17th. That's a Friday night. Show starts at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6. And once again, this is a free concert to commemorate and honor Native American Heritage Month. Free concert I'm looking forward to. This will be actually my first time seeing the group in action. I'm also the MC, so I look forward to bringing you out on stage and meeting the group. And, you know, it's humbling for me, too, because, like I said earlier, it's not work.
Well, we share that. I've never considered it work. Now, don't mistake the fact that there's a lot of hard things that have to be done. I've always kind of tried to let people know that our 2 hours on stage or whatever it is, you know, once every 10 days or however it falls, that's the icing on the cake. That's the easy part where you can kind of go on autopilot and have some fun. But, you know, it's the 90 hours before and after over the course of those 10 days or week, whatever it is, that you have to keep your nose to the grindstone, because there are a lot of things that have to happen to make this the business side of this work. So, you know, there is a factor to it. But I think the fact is that if I picked out the, you know, I said 90 hours, I was just grabbing at numbers there, but the 90 hours of work before and after a show are worth it. And you never even think about it. You know, it's well worth it. Matter of fact, you embrace it so that you got the 2 hours where you can go up and share some time with your audience and friends and family. It's all very rewarding and kind of a spiritual experience.
Yeah, and again, I got to say, you do it well. You bring the cultures together. You bring the music together. You know, back to you for a moment. Your talent playing the keyboard is stunning. You alluded to it as learning how to play instruments as a kid, but how old were you when you first touched the keyboard and started cranking out some music?
Well, first of all, let me back up. Somebody must have paid you something, Dan. A compliment like that, I don't deserve that. So.
Oh, I happen to differ on you with you on that.
Well, thank you, but I consider myself an average, mediocre keyboardist with an extraordinary amount of life and experience. So I'll go with that. And so, you know, here's the deal. I think that, you know, I was probably about 7 years old when I started in music, and strangely enough, the first instrument that I was introduced to was the accordion. Now, the accordion wasn't a very popular instrument back then, and I don't think it's really gained much in popularity since. So, it was funny. I was embarrassed to play it. Honestly, I can tell you that now. But the fact that my parents bought it for me and I took a few lessons to learn how to play it is what really started my musical career.
Native polka.
Well, I played a lot of polkas. I grew up in Southwest Minnesota, remember. So I'm probably one of the few native kids that knows how to play a bunch of polkas, you know. But as soon as I could, I was allowed to shift gears and go from the accordion to a piano to electronic instruments. And then that led me into the world of rock and roll. And so it goes. So, you know, those early influences were very important. The accordion, now I look at it, I was embarrassed as a kid to play it or to even mention it. But now I'm kind of proud that I had that opportunity and had the chance and kind of cut my chops on that unusual instrument.
It's an experience. It's part of life.
It is. Yeah, it is. But, you know, these days, the opportunities to create your music are so vast. I mean, you and I know that technology has excelled, and I think in the world of music and electronics, we've probably entered this musical journey at a time in history where all of a sudden, you know, you could create things musically with a small group of people and a few computers that you never could have done back in the early days. So I don't know. It's just sometimes I look at the timing of all this and you really can't comprehend that this all happened at this particular time this way, and it was all accident, it was all circumstance, and you know, the only thing I can come to anymore is that there was a bigger picture at work this entire time. And once you start thinking that way, you're almost overwhelmed by the fact that if this was part of a grand design, the spiritual component for us humans is really something to behold, and it's just that we don't normally think about it day in, day out. But, you know, for us, it's been thrown in our face in such a way that it overwhelms you almost every day when you think about it for just a moment.
Yep.
This could have never happened. I mean, just every little part of the story we're just talking about, it had to all fall into place just right for us to be having this conversation right now.
Yeah, I agree. Back to your comment a moment ago about the technology aspect of modern music, and I just saw A Tribe Called Red came to the Black Bear and appeared about a week ago. You know, the way they use the technology, and they're doing it with two men, and that they had people dancing from the moment they took stage, and I watched that group of people in front of the stage dancing. It started out about a third of the width of the event center, and it just worked its way across, and by mid-show, the entire front row was a swarm of people, all dancing, never stopped for the full 90 minutes. They just rocked it. And it was amazing. But there again, not having the exposure to our contemporary traditional Native artists, mainstream America hasn't learned the secret yet.
No, they haven't. And, you know, that kind of brings me to, you know, the final chapter for Brulee. Now, that kind of sounds a little morbid, but I don't mean it to sound like that. But I'm at a stage in life, Dan, where I'm looking at how am I going to use all this in the last quarter of my life? And what we've come to the conclusion that we have to continue on for as long as we can. But what we started to do is harness all this. Now, I've kind of shifted gears one more. We've taken one more big step here just in the last two or three years. We've formed a nonprofit 501c3 public charity organization. And that's no easy task when you talk about things behind the scenes other than music that have to happen so you can continue on. You know, putting that together was a task. But we were able to do it. It made its way through all the paperwork and all the bureaucracy and everything that goes with that. And then we've had the status now for about 2 years, and that's the first step. But the more important thing is, what are you going to do with that? Well, we are trying to focus our attention, and I say try because we're at the early stages of this, and I sincerely think this will be a journey that will take me through the rest of my life, and I hope that we can pass this on then and has life for many years to come. But what we're really doing is hoping to form a couple of organizations that can help the generations behind us. I'll just put it that way.
Yep.
I'm not going to confine it to the kids, but it is going to be basically for the young generations, and we want to assist in helping the young generations to find this voice, for the Native culture musically and artistically, and provide some assistance there. And like I said earlier, it doesn't exist in the mainstream music industry. They haven't ignored it. They just don't know what to do. I have to laugh many times because the music industry is always on the lookout for the next thing. They want that next deal. They want the next big thing. Where are the trends going?
You're right. Definitely.
But sometimes the trend and the next thing is so obvious that it's right in front of them. They can't see it. They want everything in place before they. It's almost like they want the circuit to exist before they will bring in the artist. Well, they have to be part of carving out the. We have to put the infrastructure together, and by that I mean, we have to come up with the sound, first of all, and we need more than a handful of our groups to do this. We need groups. We need a bunch of groups. And then what we need is writers, not only in music, but this goes into the world of video and television and movies, too. Part of the reason that we don't have a lot of representation in the modern movie industry or television is that we've got talent. I mean, we've got actors and everything else, but we need to be writing our own stories, just like we've written our own music. We need Native artists who write the story. We need Native writers who come in and write the screenplays so it stays true. And then the actors come in and can portray the characters that have been conceived in these stories. We need that whole thing to happen. And it's the same in music. We need the artists. We need to develop them and farm them, put a farm system together early so we can create the artists and let them finish developing this whole thing that we call pioneering the last musical frontier. So this is kind of what I hope our 501c3 can do and what it can become as we go into the future.
Thank you for bringing up the 501c3 because I was going to refer to it here during the interview and I wanted to hear you talk about it and you just took care of that for me and it's amazing. And to the point, my youngest son performed in a marching band in high school.
Nice.
And this was a couple years after he quit football. He had some asthma issues and then he lost his mother. She passed away very unexpectedly and he was 14 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So he found marching band through a good friend of his and they joined and it's very competitive where we lived. There's a lot of states that it's like basketball in Indiana or football in Oklahoma or Texas. It's
sure.
It's crazy, crazy competitive.
Mm-hmm.
His first year, he won a state championship.
Wow, that's something.
It is truly amazing. Then they went to Indianapolis. They were in the top 10 in the country for high school marching bands. And
wow.
And I couldn't be more proud, and not because he won a state championship or not because of the way the band performed nationally. I was proud of him because it brought him back. He found it.
Yeah.
And it's tough losing a parent or a loved one and to go through that at that age and then rediscover a joy, something to, you know, to occupy your time and your attention. And it's amazing. And the reason why I bring this up, you talk about performing arts, whether it's music, drama, whether it's chorus, any of those programs, they are the first to be on the chopping block in our school system.
That's correct.
So to drive something in that area, in that arena, to get the creative minds of those younger generations, get them thinking, performing. You know, I have students here in our school that, how do I get into this?
Mm-hmm.
They want to throw some rhymes together and it's great, but same thing. There's no exposure to a record label. And they're high school students, so they're young, and they got to kind of hone their craft a little bit. But what's out there for them when they get out of high school or college?
Mm-hmm.
It's a challenge.
It is. And if we don't do it, nobody's coming in. Now, my son has made that comment to me many times, and it sounds a bit negative, but it's reality. And we've got to get to work here. It's our generation that can initiate some of these things. And I don't know how big of a dent we can make, but I know we can make a dent, and I know that we can get started. We've had a tremendous amount of interest and initial early support for this program of ours. And by the way, you or anybody can find out more information on what we're doing here through our website, or mostly through our website. I try to keep things active and current there as to our progress with this. But stuff happens. There's a little bit of progress almost every week now. And so, you know, when we get an invitation to come into a community like Black Bear up there, you know, really for us, it's not just a chance to go perform. It's really a chance for us to reach out, to share what we're trying to do with other tribal communities. It really extends our network by leaps and bounds. So it's part of this process, you know, by being invited in. The community is really helping us to move this thing forward. You'd be surprised at the number of contacts and connections that are made with a visit like us when we come to a tribal community. So you kind of see how the whole thing comes together at some point. And sometimes it takes a lifetime to be able to see the big picture. But that's okay, because it's better to have a glimpse of the big picture and have spent a lifetime at it than to never get a peek. So it's happening right now. It is happening. And support is networking out. I think that Minnesota, if I can make a few little predictions here, and I'm not good at it, but I think I'm pretty close now on this one. I think Minnesota is probably going to be our base of operation. I would have guessed South Dakota 10 years ago, but I think Minnesota is just got more of the raw materials that are needed to make this work.
Larger market as well.
Absolutely. And then we can network out, and our outreach can branch out from there, and we'll get out as far as we can to tribal communities. But, you know, I think that we'll have a chance to embrace young artists of many different cultures once this thing really gets going. And I think it'll have a life of its own once it's set up. And then individuals like you and I can come in and play more of a role of a role model.
Mentor.
And things like that. And, you know, these young kids, they're sharp and they're good. We don't have to do much besides just set things up for them. And so that's what's happening kind of as we speak. And it's as exciting as anything that Brulé's ever done. And we're tackling the thing with as much enthusiasm and vigor and energy as we can possibly come up with.
I remember our first Thanksgiving together, my son and I, after his mother passed. And Thanksgiving Day is a big tradition in my family because we like to watch football. Guilty pleasure of mine. But we spent the morning right before, well, late morning, early afternoon, delivering Meals on Wheels in downtown Detroit and helping others. And you can say the same through your 501c3. Helping others, the reward that you feel is just phenomenal.
You're right on it, and very well said. It's a different process, and I think it's probably part of a life's process too, especially if you have been blessed along the way and been given an ample amount of opportunity. You know, if your heart is in the right place, you can't help but want to turn around and then pass that along and assist in some way. And, you know, so many times we toss out this term 501c3, but what we're really saying is we're trying to give back in some way, shape, or form for the blessings that we've received along the way. And that, in the world of business, is how you do it.
And as we say in Anishinaabe, Chi Miigwech, thank you for helping others. It's a beautiful thing. And as I said, it's a rewarding feeling. I was just going to say, I was going to switch gears here and tell you that our interview, our discussion just wouldn't be complete if I didn't give a little bit more time to that dance troupe that you have with you. We talked about the three generations. You have a granddaughter that dances as well. I saw the hoop dance performance. I believe it was Thirza Defoe.
She's been with us. She grew up, and we've seen her grow up before our eyes. So,
oh, it's amazing.
You know, I sometimes watch these dancers, and I feel like I'm just an old coach. But, you know, they've done it all. We've tried to help. We've given them the stage and started the music, but they've taken over from there. And so I'm very proud of the kind of the dance troupe and the dance component. In reality, Dan, I have to say that it includes so many performers that I can't even mention them all. But I must say that we've tried to include traditional dancers from as many different tribal communities as we possibly could. We'll never hit them all. I mean, there's over 550 recognized tribes across the United States. So for us to get a member of each of those communities in to give them, you know, dance time, it's probably never going to happen that we'll get them all. But we're getting a lot of them, and that's part of the beauty that I think that the audience can absorb during one of our shows, is that, you know, we haven't restricted the dance component to a Northern Plains style or a Lakota style. We've tried to include as many as we possibly can. You know, one of my biggest visions and dreams included what I call a Native American, almost a theme park setting, where you have a massive amount of area where all the tribes can come in, present their unique components to their tribal stories, their legends, their dance, their contemporary aspects. And once you do that, once I started to work on that and started to look at what the contributions would, how that would look on a big scale, it's a massive thing. It's so big. I don't know if it'll ever happen, but it's sure a fun dream at this point. And it's just one of the things that we kind of, you know, that we dream about. But in terms of the dance component, if you could ever see, I mean, you maybe have been to the Gathering of Nations, the really big powwows. Once that grand entry happens and you see, you know, 500 dancers out there all at the same time, it's pretty impressive. Oh. You know, there's nothing like it. And so it has been so important for us to have as much representation as we can tribally within our small dance troupe. But the reality is that many times we'll have, you know, like I say, 8 to 10 dancers and a minimum of 5 most of the time. And you have family members in there that kind of anchor the thing. But the dance, you know, in its glory, you know, on a large stage, I mean, if you could ever really put the big dance show together, it's something the world would behold. So it's one of our visions for the future. But the dance members, I owe a great debt to. They've all come in and worked very hard. Most of them have put more time and energy into what they've been compensated for, but that's been irrelevant. They've contributed. They've made the impression along the way with the public, and they've been good role models in themselves, and that's really the important thing. They've made a good impression on the mainstream audience.
Well, and combining the visual with the audio is the cherry on top of the proverbial sundae. It brings so much to the performance. And they mix so well together.
Well, you know what? It's thank you. It's kind of like, once again, now tell me that the entertainment industry isn't looking for something grandiose and something big. I mean,
well, I agree with you, but do you share it or does it become exploited? There's that fine
line.
That's
the question. It really is. That's the million-dollar question. I don't know if I'll be able to answer it, but I can tell you that you have to be careful there. I didn't tell you this little tidbit that's kind of interesting. It keeps me in line. But back in the early days of Brulé, probably year 5, we had an encounter with a manager, a big-time entertainment manager from New York. I mean, I talked to him on the phone. I could literally smell the cigar he was smoking over the phone. So we met, and you know, his idea, and they were going to put millions into this and tour this around the world, but in a nutshell, they wanted to take Brulé and turn it into a Native American Kiss. And you know where I'm going with that. And I knew where he was going with it. And we had to pass on that. You know, it didn't take us long to say that we were, and they couldn't believe it, that we were passing on it. And in a way, we passed on it, and it kind of carried a little bit of a blacklist scenario that we had to live out. Because you just don't walk away from something like that. You know, you have to, you know, the word gets out. But there was nobody else that came in behind us that took the offer up either. I mean, we all kind of held our ground. We had to. So, you know, it isn't always jumping at the next big deal, or the bigger show is the better show. I only say grandiose because it's a natural thing in our culture. Once our dancers are out there, it's massive and it's entertaining and it's heart-stopping. So we have that aspect. It's a natural component of our culture. It's already there. You know, it's built in.
It doesn't matter which tribal community, but I can only say that when I saw your 2007 video, because I've never seen you live, to see it all on stage together, they complement each other on a very nice package. It's cultural. It's you. It's your family. It's your group. I would be hard-pressed to imagine anybody questioning your thought process or your dedication. We touched on it.
We've never had a negative experience all these years, and that says a lot, you know. And we've had more than our fair share of support from tribal communities, and that feels good. Obviously, the mainstream has embraced this thing. But, you know, I think there's something in the performance that's there for the world. And maybe the fact that it never found a home in the mainstream is a blessing. I can only say that because that's how most everything else has gone. It probably has been part of that big picture that I talk about once in a while. Because, you know, if we had fit into the mainstream and fell under the guise of a record label and the big machine came in behind us, who knows where it would have gone. We maybe would have lost control of the thing, but by hanging on to it, keeping the direction sound, I found that, and this is just something I got to pull myself out of, but this next statement is very profound. I think the Native American culture has something, especially at this moment in history, when we look at all the world news.
Oh, goodness.
I mean, we have something within our culture that I believe that needs to be put out into the world. And I can't put my finger on it. It's not a statement. It's not a dance. It's not a sound. It's a spirit that comes from within the culture that's always been there. It's a natural thing that human beings have always had, but we lose track of it. I can tell you we lost track of it because in the world I grew up in, it wasn't there. I discovered it halfway through life in the small little Indian reservation in central South Dakota. That spirit was still alive. Whatever that is, that needs to go out into the world because it does something. It makes a difference. That's where I was going with that. It needs to be released, and I think that's another thing that our culture has been called upon to do at this particular time in history, and it's important that we get the younger generations involved so they can continue this thing on.
I think that spirit was awakened with a vengeance a little over a year ago, a little bit north of you, a little bit west of me in North Dakota.
Absolutely.
The Black Snake.
Yep.
And
I'm right with you on
they're
that.
They're still fighting about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, whatever the case is that, you know, we have a chance to help be part of this. You're doing it with your help. The tribal community in northern Minnesota is playing a very big, important role. Black Bear Casino and all their resources are one of the few across the country, and I'm not picking on them, but I'm trying to give a compliment where it should go. That tribal community has played a very big role in helping this to move forward. We don't need every tribe to participate, and we don't need every casino to be helping along the way. We just need a handful. We'll hopscotch back and forth between the ones that are helping out, and we'll try to make as big of an impression as we can while we're there.
Yeah, and proximity is everything, too.
It is.
Where that casino is located, getting more people to learn more about Brulé and every other Native group that performs.
Absolutely.
That hidden, yeah. That secret we talked about.
Yeah, it is. They've played such an important role up there. So you'll hear me during the show pass along our gratitude on behalf of not just Brulé, but on behalf of that bigger group of Native artists that need that resource, that need that venue to get up on to present our craft and our music and our message. And we're just part of it. But we'll be saying thank you as many times and as big a way as we possibly can. I do it every time that I get the opportunity when we've been invited into a tribal community. So, I mean, we're really looking forward to it.
I know we're running a little bit short on time here, but I wanted to ask you one of my final questions. If you would, please, talk about the American Indian Rock Opera.
That's a great little story. I'll keep it kind of short, but the lesson is very profound. It's got a neat ring to it. And believe me, there's a vision behind it. But the reality of it, it was a survival. It's a survival entity. And I'll tell you what happened is that, you know, you mentioned record labels, and we've had this talk and this conversation. But we were actually signed to a small record label in our early days, that first decade of Brulé. Most of the work musically was under the umbrella of a small independent record label based out of Albuquerque. For the most part, they did a decent job. And I wouldn't change it. We had to do most of the work because it was an independent label, so we did everything. I mean, we produced the music, we wrote it, we recorded it. The fact is that it was manufactured. It basically was just distributed by the record label. That's kind of how it worked. And anytime you do that, there's contractual obligations. Well, we got to a point to where we wanted to do more. We wanted to get more sounds out. Brulé was contracted to be an instrumental music group. From the start, it wasn't our first choice. I'd grown up as a singer in a rock and roll band, so I was familiar with vocals and loved to sing. But the contract called for instrumental music only, so that's what we had to produce. We wanted to do more, and the only way we could do that was to create a new entity. So the American Indian Rock Opera became our version of the artist formerly known as Prince. It was a way for us to get more music out and a little bit different sound than what we were confined to by the record label. And as time went by, it all worked out. These days, it's all kind of lumped together. But when we were exploring and working on that concept, it was more than just a concept. It really was. It was an idea for a musical format that really became bigger than life. And I would think, Dan, that probably one of my final projects will be, and I don't know when I'll finish this. I have started it, but one of my great goals musically in the balance of my life is to write the great American Indian instrumental music performance that could be Broadway worthy. And that is the American Indian rock opera in its full essence.
Wow. Paul Rush here. He's the founder of Brulé. And I wanted to share, or actually with our listeners, earlier we talked about you worrying about selling 30 CDs at a performance. Now today you've sold well over 1 million CDs. You've traveled all over North America. I don't know the countries that you've traveled in. I wanted to ask you, I see you're going to California in the near future. Winter's setting in here in the upper Midwest, and it's time to go a little bit warmer. Any thought into that, or how did that come about?
Well, I wish I could say I'm smart enough to head south in the winter, but I'm not. It just happens to be the luck of the draw. We have a few dates coming up here that'll take us to California and down into Phoenix and New Mexico. And it just happens. I mean, it can be in the middle of summer as well. So we take them as they come along. Obviously, a trip to California is a little bit more enjoyable this time of
year. Indeed.
But, you know, it's just the way it's gone. And I really need to give a little credit to my wife, Kathy. I've been married for 43 years. And she's been there from the start. We were high school sweethearts, so she's lived every moment of this journey. And she's been our business manager and booking agent all these years, and she's managed to single-handedly keep us busy for 23 years.
Amazing.
And she's done a great job, and she's learned. I mean, I really think that she's one of the best agents out there right now. I mean, we just do it ourselves, but she's had to carve out that little infrastructure that I said that the labels couldn't figure out, and she's done it. All of these trips and these engagements are all with her, kind of with her handiwork and her blessing over the thing. So she's done a great job over the years. We wouldn't be here without her.
Yeah, she her commission, you get to see a little bit of that back yourself, I would imagine.
No, I don't. No, it all lumps together. And the fact is that, you know, this is an odd little topic, but I'll say it carefully. You know, when people see that we've sold a large number of records and they think that you're a millionaire, you know, and I think we are spiritually, but the money, if we've made money along the way, it's all gone back into our operation. I mean, that's the only way you can sustain a 23-year career musically without the help of anybody else in terms of a record label or a manager or an agent or any big machine that comes in to induce money into your operation. It's all been, all the money that's kept us going has come from a handshake that turns into a CD sale that you sign, and that individual has supported us by buying that CD, and pretty soon there's been 1 million of them. And you've just recycled everything back into the next gig, the next job, the next road trip, the next recording, and somehow you manage to always get to the next job.
Where can fans, listeners, where can they find your music? Is it on your website? And if so, please share.
Thank you. The best way that I would like to send somebody is, and I don't mean this in a selfish way, but come visit our website. You know, I've been disappointed in almost every other resource over the years. You know, the record industry is changing so much that you can't, CDs and stores are going away at such a fast pace. You might as well forget that. So our website has got everything on, Dan. I mean, I think people will enjoy it. You can listen to every one of our songs, every one of our CDs from start to finish. It's free music streaming. You can watch all of our television shows. We've produced over 100 episodes of half-hour TV shows that present different neat little things about the Native American culture. It's a series called Hidden Heritage. It's all on our website, free to watch. It used to be on Vimeo as a subscription service. Nowadays, it's free to our viewers. All of our history, all of our archives, pictures that go back to, 22 years worth of media on the website. So go there and check that out. Have some fun with it. Join our mailing list. Tell some friends. And it's www.bruelrecords.com. We've geared the thing so that our fan base can enjoy what we're doing.
Phenomenal. Any final thoughts?
Just that we've been blessed along the way. Thank you to everybody who's been part of that process. I know that we've got a lot of supporters up in that part of Minnesota, and anybody who may be listening to the program, just a hearty, heartfelt thank you from all of us in Brulé for your support over the years. Come on out to the show and join us. It's at the Compliments of the Tribe. It's a free concert, which is very rare, too. One more thing the tribal community has done for the culture. So come on out and join the website, mailing list, and follow our progress with the 501c3 and help along the way if you possibly can.
That's awesome. And a reminder that the Brulé concert at the Black Bear Casino Resort, Outer Creek Event Center, and that'll be this Friday, November 17th. Show starts at 7 p.m. Doors open at 6. Free concert, as Paul alluded to a moment ago, and I'm so looking forward to it. Paul, thank you so much for your time, and we will see you soon. Take care.
Thanks, Dan.
You bet. 89.1 WGZS Cloquet.